Welcome to Boston Globe Live. This program is intended for print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. In the next hour, we will be bringing you the news from the Wednesday, July 29th edition of the Boston Globe. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Beverly, reading with Kathy, live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. We now begin with the front page news. Cameras might bring crackdown on speeders. Beacon Hill may be ready to back changes this time. By Didi Coley, Boston Globe. Massachusetts could soon allow traffic speed cameras to proliferate on city roads and state highways after a decade of proposals failed to cross the finish line at the State House, a provision state senators slipped into the $575 million economic development bill last week would permit automated cameras in school zones and other designated safety zones, as well as near active highway construction sites across the state. Drivers caught going 11 miles per hour over the posted limit would face fines between $25 and $100. Bills allowing for traffic cameras have long languished on Beacon Hill, bogged down by concerns about the camera's efficacy and recurring debates about invasion of privacy and potentially inflaming racial disparities in communities of color. Already, Black and Hispanic drivers are pulled over and arrested at disproportionately higher rates than white drivers, research shows. Healy has repeated the idea of allowing speed cameras, though whether the House will embrace the change too when it negotiates a final version of the economic development bill remains to be seen. In its current form, the amendment would let cities and towns choose the camera locations on municipal streets, though they would have to submit a plan for implementing the program for approval from the Department of Transportation. State officials would place the technology on highways. The policy would not allow frontal photos of passengers or drivers, and it would explicitly ban using facial recognition with the cameras. Captured images of license plates would be destroyed shortly after any case is disposed of and not be considered public record. Traffic fatalities nationwide spiked after the COVID pandemic subsided, reversing years of steady decline. The frequency of wrong-way crashes is growing, causing a spate of fatal accidents within just a few weeks earlier this summer. More than 160 people have already died on Massachusetts roads in 2026. Peter Savalanian, a road safety expert and professor at Michigan State University, said collecting more revenue is not the primary aim of traffic cameras. Rather, the goal, he said, is to create safer roads and reduce the strain on local law enforcement. Plunking a police car by the roadside is very effective at slowing traffic, but there are major resource constraints there. Cameras serve the same function, and they are more permanent but less cost prohibitive. New Hampshire could still be the first primary despite DNC. Much is up in the air, but the state may still have a workaround, by James Pendell, Globe staff. The decision by the DNC to downgrade New Hampshire's traditional role as the first presidential primary in the nation to the third contest raised a lot of questions, especially considering there is a state law requiring the Granite State to hold the first primary. Complicating matters is that Republicans in 2028 will continue to use the traditional schedule for their primary presidential primary season. Iowa caucuses first, followed by the New Hampshire primary, then South Carolina and Nevada. Democrats, meanwhile, are poised to blow up that calendar entirely. They aim to have the South Carolina primary first, followed by Nevada, New Hampshire, Michigan, New Mexico, and Virginia. Super Tuesday would come afterward. Some of the bigger questions about the DNC's decision will only be answered as the situation plays out over the next week, year and a half. New Hampshire has a clever workaround for now. New Hampshire will always hold the nation's first presidential primary. The question is whether that first primary will matter. Will there be candidates who apply to be on the ballot? Will voters bother to show up? Will anyone actually care about the results? On that, we just don't know yet. For now, the modus operandi for New Hampshire Democrats is really clear. Don't do a single thing to trigger the DNC into saying New Hampshire has gone rogue, because buried within the DNC rules is a provision that if a candidate campaigns in a state that is not in compliance with the calendar the DNC approves, that candidate can be banned from participating in debates and from having access to the National Democratic voter file. But as long as New Hampshire Democrats publicly maintain that they intend to go third and run their own primary, candidates can campaign in the state, hire staff, and air ads just as they have every 4 years. All of that continues until New Hampshire's Secretary of State announces the date of the Republican and Democratic state primary. At that point, New Hampshire Democrats can say they have nothing to do with that and are staying within the rules. That is what happened in 2024 when the DNC said New Hampshire should go second. But that change wasn't announced this far out, and New Hampshire Democrats had to pretend for just a few months that they were going to remain in compliance. The new calendar makes it less likely that a candidate can emerge out of nowhere. The old adage is presidential primary politics is that Democrats like to fall in love and Republicans like to fall in line. It's how, for example, Democrats got behind Barack Obama in 2008, while Republicans once again nominated the guy who came in second during the competitive GOP primary, John McCain. The traditional calendar created a level playing field that valued message and campaigning over money. An upstart candidate could campaign for relatively little in New Hampshire and Iowa and win there, proving viability. Think Obama, Jimmy Carter, or for a time, Pete Buttigieg. In 2028, an unknown or underfunded candidate would have to not just compete in South Carolina with expensive media markets, but then create campaign organizations and advertise in six different states simultaneously. In other words, the game just shifted to give a further advantage to well-known brands like Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, Gavin Newsom, Josh Shapiro, and others who may not have the right message at this moment, but have the right infrastructure. Graham eulogized as an American original. Senator Lindsey Graham, the son of pool hall owners, who rose to become one of his generation's most influential U.S. politicians at home and abroad, was eulogized on Tuesday. Graham's casket arrived at the Capitol, where the Republican served for more than 30 years as an indefatigable dealmaker who talked and laughed and badgered his colleagues into action. Among those who gathered were Israelis Benjamin Netanyahu and Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky, leaders of two countries fighting separate wars, a nod to Graham's role as a foremost believer in the power of the U.S. and its military to intervene in the world's problems. He was elected to the Senate in the 2002 election. There he formed an alliance with John McCain, a Republican from Arizona, and Joe Lieberman, an independent from Connecticut, in what would become the Three Amigos, globe-trotting the world focused on national security issues. For decades, Graham had been at the center of the action, a member of virtually every bipartisan gang in Congress, with a relentless ability to adapt to political realities, particularly when it came to Trump. FDA asserts food supply safe. and this is from the Nation section of the Globe and from the New York Times. Even as the number of cyclospora cases in the U.S. hit record levels, top health regulators insisted that consumers could still trust what they are eating. It's been a rough summer when it comes to foodborne illnesses. Nearly 100 people have been reported ill with salmonella, leading to the recall last week of 19 million eggs linked to part of the outbreak. An E. coli infection was traced to some organic blueberries. And earlier in the summer, a listeria outbreak led to the recall of various soft cheeses. Still, the outbreaks of cyclosporiasis sweeping the country are top of mind for the hundreds of food safety experts gathered for their annual conference in New Orleans. Across many conference panels and in hallways between meetings, some participants expressed concern that the root cause of the ongoing outbreaks may never be known. And without understanding how certain produce or other foods became contaminated in the first place, some said they fear that there might not be an end to what some have deemed cyclospora season for consumers. One pocket of the cyclosporiasis outbreak that has sickened 1,900 people and hospitalized 98 has been linked to iceberg lettuce grown in Mexico and served at some Taco Bell locations. That led Taylor Farms, the country's largest produce supplier, to voluntarily recall lettuce shipped to 27 states. The FDA identified a new outbreak that has sickened at least 72 people, according to the agency's website. At the same time, officials in North Carolina are trying to track down an outbreak that they do not believe is related to the iceberg lettuce, but that has resulted in more than 300 cases of cyclosporiasis in the state. They are eyeing parsley, cilantro, and lettuce as potential culprits there. Even though regulators have identified iceberg lettuce from Mexico as the source for some of the outbreaks and that lettuce has been recalled, the number of cases of cyclosporiasis and of unrelated outbreaks keeps climbing. But if identifying the food that is the source of cyclosporiasis outbreak is difficult, pinpointing where and how the contamination occurred is even more challenging, many scientists in attendance said. Cyclospora is a parasite that spreads through human feces and is rare for the investigators to locate a precise source of contamination. Produce, whether cilantro, berries, or leafy greens, is imported nearly every day from many other countries. And from Canada, we have whale of an effort. Aquarium relocating 30 beluga whales from Canada. There is nothing normal about moving a beluga whale. First, you have to find a cargo plane that can accommodate the whale and at least one attendant, if not more, per whale. Then there are foam and rubber-lined container boxes specific to the whale's size and weight, and large enough to hold the water, whale, and the stretcher that it will rest on. There's also the matter of the crane that will hoist the whale from its enclosure into the box onto a waiting truck that will cart it off to the airport. Now repeat that for 30 whales. Aquariums across the United States and Spain are working to relocate those 30 whales from a shuttered aquarium in Canada. Six made their way out of Canada last week on the first transfer plane, four to the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago and two to SeaWorld San Antonio, with 20 more expected to be transported in the coming weeks. Georgia Aquarium in Atlanta, SeaWorld San Diego, and Oceanographic Valencia in Spain will receive belugas. The Mystic Aquarium in Connecticut is helping with the transports. The animals are coming from Marineland, an aquatic park in Niagara Falls, Ontario, that closed to the public in 2024. The animals have remained in the care of the aquarium staff members, some of whom have worked with these animals for decades. It was not immediately clear how much the rescues would cost, but Ash said Marineland, the Canadian government, and the receiving aquariums were all splitting the bill. SeaWorld said it expected the costs to be in the millions. And we will be back after a brief break.
Are you having difficulty with your eyesight? Are you losing your vision? Are you afraid of what comes next? If you're blind or visually impaired, contact Mass Commission for the Blind to find out if you're eligible to register for services. Learn new skills to reclaim your independence. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450.
And we are back with Boston Globe Live, a production of, sorry about that. We are back after a break. You're listening to Kathy, and we are Boston Globe Live, a production of Audio Journal.
From the opinion section of the Boston Globe, this is an article entitled, Trump's Iran War Casualty Numbers Don't Add Up. This is a column by Renee Graham, who is a Globe columnist. The Pentagon first said it was a glitch. Last Thursday, one day after four U.S. service members killed this month in the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran received a dignified transfer at Dover Air Base in Delaware, their names disappeared from the Pentagon's public tracker for military casualties. Instead of 18 deaths during this war, the website listed 14. A Pentagon spokesman claimed that the removal was due to temporary data disruptions. But when the four names reappeared on the site, they were listed under a new separate category, overseas operations. The official number of war fatalities remained at 14. President Trump, who was convicted on 34 counts of falsifying business records in 2024, is cooking the books again, this time with the numbers of Iran war dead and wounded. When the administration began what it calls Operation Epic Fury on February 28th, Trump boasted that the war would be over in 4 to 5 weeks. It's now in its fifth month. The president has repeatedly and falsely claimed that Iran's military has been destroyed. Yet there's no end in sight for this war. Dozens of times, Trump has declared that a deal to end the war was imminent, only for Iran's leaders to quickly contradict him. But even in an administration where mendacity is policy, reclassifying war deaths to manipulate public opinion for this deeply unpopular war is unconscionable. What this administration is showing is that it holds the same disdain for this nation's military as Trump has always displayed. As a presidential candidate in 2015, Trump, who finagled his way into 5 deferments to avoid the draft in 1968, denigrated the more than 5 years that then-Senator John McCain of Arizona spent in a North Vietnamese prison camp during the Vietnam War. When Trump became this nation's commander-in-chief, he declined to attend a 2018 ceremony at a French cemetery for U.S. troops killed during World War II. According to senior staff members quoted by The Atlantic, Trump said, "Why should I go to that cemetery? It's filled with losers." On that same trip, Trump reportedly called more than 1,800 Marines who died during World War I's Battle of Belleau Wood in France suckers for getting killed. Now Trump apparently sees service members who lost their lives as nothing more than numbers to be shuffled around for his political advantage. Also worth noting, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth hasn't held a press briefing in more than 2 months, meaning he hasn't faced questions about the U.S. military strategy or lack thereof in this war. Last week, the New York Times reported that the Pentagon withheld information that more than 100 troops had been injured since July 7th. Now, with more than 600 service members wounded, 207 have been moved from the list of those injured in the war to that nebulous overseas operations category. Even in the most corrupt administration in American history, misclassifying U.S. casualties achieves a singular foulness. By hiding the human toll of this war, Trump may believe he can continue to portray himself as a military mastermind whose deft actions are preventing greater injury and death. As he did for troops killed at the beginning of the war, Trump attended the dignified transfer of the four U.S. service members killed in action this month. It's the very least a president can do for those he sends into harm's way. But this obligatory gesture can't conceal the profound disrespect that Trump is showing by trying to discount their deaths. Continuing on the opinion page, this is an article entitled "From the Pediatric Trauma Room, A Warning About E-Bikes." This is written by Dr. Cornelia Griggs, who is a pediatric surgeon at Mass General Brigham for Children Hospital and an assistant professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School. Caitlin Coit is the pediatric trauma program manager at Mass General Brigham for Children's Hospital. "It's too fast, it's too fast." Those were the words a 12-year-old boy recently screamed at a playground in Lynn in the seconds after he lost control of his e-bike. He had just fallen off the bike, which kept going without him. 60 pounds of steel and lithium, riderless, still accelerating across the blacktop until it crashed and nearly crushed a 2-year-old boy on the playground. The toddler's mother later described what happened the way people describe a car crash: sirens, parents fumbling for their phones, and a few feet away, the boy who had been riding, weeping and shaking, a child himself, seeing what his bike had done. The toddler arrived in our pediatric trauma bay via MedFlight. "We are a pediatric surgeon and a pediatric trauma nurse practitioner. We want to be very clear about what happened on that playground, because we keep hearing it called an accident. It was not. It was a crash, the predictable result of handing a motor vehicle to a child." E-bike-related emergency department visits in Massachusetts more than doubled in the first half of this year, according to the State Department of Public Health. School let out and visits increased. So far this summer, we have cared for children with bleeding livers and ruptured spleens, punctured lungs, broken femurs, fractured spines, and brain swelling inside skulls that struck pavement at 30 miles an hour. Some of those children will not get all of themselves back. These are not the injuries of childhood bike riding. We know what those look like: a wrist fracture, a chin that needs 4 stitches, gravel in a knee. What we are seeing now is motor vehicle trauma, and it arrives in bodies that weigh 80 pounds. The word e-bike is misleading. The bicycles we grew up on were lighter than most e-bikes and went as fast as our legs could push them. Today's e-bikes weigh more than a traditional bike and hit 20 to 30 miles per hour with a twist of the wrist. Some go faster. Physics does not care that we call it a bike. Double the speed and you'll quadruple the energy. And in a crash, that energy goes into a child. The problem is not just age, it's development. Part of the brain that governs judgment, impulse control, and the ability to see 3 seconds into the future is not finished until a person hits their mid-20s. Adolescents overestimate their own competence and underestimate the risk. They are slower to recognize a hazard and less practiced at deciding what to do in the half-second they have. This is not a character flaw, and it is not parenting failure. It's biology, and it is why society doesn't let 13-year-olds drive a car or a motorcycle. We should stop pretending an e-bike is meaningfully different. Listen to that boy again. It's too fast. He was right, and he understood it only in the moment it stopped mattering. The price of that discovery was paid by a toddler who never saw it coming. Massachusetts is closer to acting than many states. The legislature deserves credit for advancing the Ride Safe Act, which proposes regulations of these devices by speed, setting a minimum age for the faster machines, and possibly closing the gap in crash reporting that has kept these injuries invisible. Massachusetts should finish the job. Three things would save children's lives: a reasonable minimal age and speed limit, as New Jersey has already done for motorized bicycles, an enforced helmet required for every rider on every motorized device, and a ban on motorized devices on sidewalks and playgrounds, where toddlers who cannot yet run are learning to walk. A motorized bike is a vehicle, and it should be treated like one, with an age requirement, a proper helmet, and rules about where it can go. And now we will move on to the Metro section. This is a column by Yvonne Abraham. It is entitled Mothers and Mental Illness. Same judge, same district, same attorney, same murder charges, same insanity plea. Same attempt to send a mother to prison for the rest of her life because she doesn't conform to the prosecutor's caricature of what mental illness is supposed to look like. It worked against Latarsha Sanders, the Brockton mother found guilty in 2022 of first-degree murder for killing her two youngest children. Hardly anybody was watching that trial closely at the time, save for Sanders' family, who were grieving the loss of Marlon, 8, and Lawson, 5, and the mother who killed them in 2018. An expert testified Sanders was in the grip of psychosis at the time. Will it work against Lindsay Clancy, the labor and delivery nurse who killed her three young children in January 2023, a month after Sanders was convicted? In stark contrast, legions are tuning into this case. The courtroom was packed as testimony in Clancy's trial began on Monday. The proceedings carried live by numerous outlets, including The Globe. Sanders was poor and black. Her case didn't attract even a fraction of the national attention and outpouring of sympathy for her family that Clancy's has. Sanders' family had no resources to correct the narrative in the wake of the killings, to explain how Sanders' mental illness had been worsening over the years, how she resisted treatment. And so, mostly unseen at the time, the prosecutor was able to turn Sanders into a monster in the courtroom. Clancy is a middle-class white woman from Duxbury with all the resources that implies. Following the killings, her loved ones and her attorney made sure to tell the world she was a loving mother who would never have harmed her children if not for her profound postpartum mental illness. Unlike in Sanders' case, there is extensive evidence of Clancy's mental health struggles leading up to the killings, contained in her medical records and in a pair of civil lawsuits against her health providers. They lay out the family's repeated, fruitless attempts to get her postpartum mental illness under control. She was given more than 30 prescriptions in the months before the killings. "I wasn't married to a monster," her former husband Patrick Clancy told The New Yorker in 2024. "I was married to someone who got sick." Far more eyes are on Plymouth District Attorney Timothy Cruz and his assistant prosecutors this time. Calling Clancy evil probably won't fly, so they're going with selfish and controlling and arguing that the woman who killed her children was not the loving woman depicted in the photographs and videos presented in the jury so far. Oftentimes, people have a caricature in mind of what someone is like who would commit a heinous crime, according to forensic psychiatrist Dr. Mark Rudolph, when I reported on the Sanders case last year. More often than not, however, that is not how someone presents who is psychotic. The natural response to a tragedy like this is to want to hold somebody accountable, because how can a person who does such a thing go unpunished? We will now pause for a brief public service announcement.
Would you like to hear news from Fitchburg and Leominster that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Wednesday at 4 p.m.
And welcome back. You are listening to Audio Journal, Boston Globe Live. And this is Beverly, and we will be continuing with the nation section of the Globe. Fauci's private notes are released. By Cheryl Gay Stolberg, New York Times. The world was just awakening to the novel coronavirus, and a full-fledged pandemic was still in the future when Dr. Anthony Fauci jotted a note in his diary on January 26, 2020, musing about whether the virus might have originated in an open-air wet market where live animals were sold in Wuhan, China. Now we know the market was not the source, it was an amplifier, he wrote, having said that somewhere the virus jumped from animals to humans. Those private reflections became public this past weekend when Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, released more than 1,000 pages of Fauci's daily notes as part of his investigation into whether the virus might have leaked from a laboratory and whether, as Paul claims, Fauci lied to Congress about it. The diary does not provide the smoking gun the senator is seeking. Rather, it echoes the past disclosures showing Fauci wrestling with a fast-moving crisis as scientists' views evolved. But it further inflames a political battle over the origins of the virus and how history should treat Fauci. It paints a portrait of Fauci as obsessed with himself, reveling in his own importance. It shows the pressure he was under as he became the public face of the government's response, while at the same time countering what he called slanderous lies about him spread by extreme right elements in society. Today, Wednesday, Fauci is scheduled to testify under the subpoena before the State Homeland Security Committee, which Paul chairs. Although Fauci received a preemptive pardon from President Joe Biden, Paul has repeatedly referred him to the Justice Department for criminal prosecution. What he wrote privately and what he told the country are two different stories, the senator wrote on the social media platform X. The debate over whether COVID-19 leaked from a lab, either accidentally or intentionally, has raged for years. Some Republicans fixed on it after President Trump floated the idea in the early months of the pandemic in his first term. Democrats rejected the theory, insisting that Trump was trying to blame China while distracting attention from his administration's failings in containing the COVID spread. And from the Associated Press, 15-year-old had a ghost gun. The 15-year-old arrested after a shootout at a food festival near Seattle's Space Needle over the weekend was armed with a ghost gun with an extended magazine. The police chief told a news conference that the weapon was a 9mm gun from Polymer 80, a now-defunct company that was once a leading manufacturer of ghost gun parts. The shooting at the Bite of Seattle Festival left three people dead, including a 19-year-old gunman, and at least four people injured, including a toddler. Authorities say they believe the violence was gang-related and are reviewing available surveillance video and interviewing victims and witnesses. Ghost guns are privately made, often homemade. Firearms that lack serial numbers used to trace them. They have often been purchased without a background check. Law enforcement officials say ghost guns, including those made with 3D printers, have been used in violent crimes across the country. Lawsuits and state-level bans eventually pushed Polymer 80 out of business in 2024, and last year the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a rule adopted under President Joe Biden requiring companies to treat gun kits like firearms by adding serial numbers, running background checks, and verifying that buyers are 21 or older. In a document filed in juvenile court in Seattle on Monday, police said that they believe there were at least three shooters, the 15-year-old, an acquaintance who died at the scene, and at least one other unknown subject. And moving on to the world section of the globe, France evacuates thousands more as fires spread. French authorities ordered 4,000 more people evacuated from tourist sites along its Atlantic coast on Tuesday, widening what may be France's largest peacetime evacuation as returning heat threatened firefighters' fragile hold on a vast wildfire west of Bordeaux. Fresh flames erupted Tuesday near Grand Gaulle, a popular Atlantic beach at the Ligier-Seyferey Peninsula. A fleet of 23 planes and helicopters dropped water and fire retardant as crews fought to keep the renewed flames from spreading. The situation remains complicated, that's clear. We're not out of the woods, a spokesperson said. She said that 60,000 residents who were evacuated as a precaution outside the Bordeaux's Ring Road could return on Tuesday. Residents were told to keep their mobile phones on and emergency bags packed. Across France and Spain, roughly 330 people have been driven from homes and vacation sites by huge wildfires. Spain braced for its fourth heat wave of the summer, with several blazes still burning out of control, including the largest in its recorded history. The Gironde fire has burned an area four times the size of Paris and forced 220,000 people to evacuate. It is very likely the largest civilian evacuation operation carried out in the country outside war. The precautionary evacuation order covered campsites, holiday villages, tourist residences, and leisure parks around the resort of Lancau-Gironde, regional authorities said. At its most violent, the Gironde blaze created a gargantuan black thundercloud, electrified and lit from within. It generated lightning, violent winds, and new fires beyond the original front. The phenomenon was the first ever recorded in France. Europe is the world's fastest warming continent, heating at more than twice the global average, according to the European Union's Copernicus Climate Service. Western Europe recorded its hottest June on record, with extreme heat and widespread dryness contributing to the spread and intensification of fires, Copernicus said. And also in the world section from the New York Times, through the smoke, vintners worry. Bordeaux, France. Draped in vines and flanked by half-timbered towers, the castle of Chateau Smith Lafitte dates to 1365. It is the kind of legacy that gives its proprietors a sense of permanence. But in the past week, a rampaging forest fire west of Bordeaux, one of the worst since World War II, forcing hundreds of thousands to evacuate, has burned to within 10 miles of the chateau's meticulously tended vineyards. That has shaken both the chateau and Bordeaux's winemaking industry, which was already staggering under multiple burdens, drought, heat waves, weak sales because of changing drinking patterns, and President Trump's tariffs on French wine. The chateau is preparing for once unthinkable scenario in which a fire could reach its buildings. It has made plans to evacuate its animals, which include horses, goats, and llamas. And lastly, Iran is in no rush to talk with the United States, from the New York Times. Iran's skies have been free of the sound of explosions and airstrikes for the past several days. Iranian officials say they have not agreed to a ceasefire, are in no hurry to hold direct talks with its U.S. negotiators. Instead, Iranian officials insist they are in a position of strength, dismiss U.S. claims that they are eager to return to negotiation. The rhetoric coming from Iran indicates that its leaders are comfortable with the state of limbo between peace and full-fledged war, believing they can handle renewed conflict and they have the leverage over President Trump. The priority for Iran seems to be regaining recognition of its control over the Strait of Hormuz, a concession the U.S. has been unwilling to make. Despite the bluster, the uncertainty is a challenge for Iran, analysts say. Fighting could break out again at any time. A settlement appears distant, and Iran's economy is almost certain to deteriorate further because of instability, wartime destruction, and U.S. naval blockade. Iranian diplomats have reacted with restraint to the pause in the fighting over the past 2 days, but there is little hint that they are in the mood for compromise. At present, what exists cannot be described as a ceasefire. Trump said that Iran had asked for a pause to meet for talks and that the two sides were engaged in discussions. "We're talking right now," he told reporters Monday aboard Air Force One, adding that there was a good chance a new round of diplomacy with Iran could yield a breakthrough. Baqai denied that there were any negotiations in the U.S. currently. Iran faces stark internal divisions over the diplomatic contacts with hardliners opposed to resuming negotiations and denouncing the elected government, which has engaged in talks in pursuit of a ceasefire. Iran's negotiations, Baqai said, were with Oman over management of the Strait of Hormuz, the critical waterway for oil and gas shipment that Iran effectively shut down after being attacked by the U.S. and Israel in February. They believe that time is on their side, that they can absorb pain and pressure more successfully than Donald Trump can, and that ultimately he will agree to a deal that fits their demands without any concession from their side. This was said by a senior analyst on Iran at the Eurasia Group, a political risk advisory firm. The recent resumption of fighting caused oil prices to surge, raising prices at the gas pump for American consumers. Oil prices had fallen sharply after the U.S. and Iran paused their attacks. Trump faces a painful dilemma in deciding his next step on Iran. The New York Times reported Saturday that private U.S. deliberations over the war have focused on the Pentagon's shrinking stockpiles of air defense munitions, making a return to war high risk. That is just one of the several concerns for U.S. officials, along with the danger of a widening war, the effect on Persian Gulf allies, and the global energy supplies. And we will take a few minutes for a short break.
Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week, including the Gardner News. You can hear the Gardner News every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Stay in touch with your community by tuning in to Audio Journal. The Gardner News, every Wednesday at 6 p.m.
And welcome back. You are listening to Boston Globe Live, a production of Audio Journal. And this is Kathy with more news.
Continuing with the Metro section, this is an article by Brian Hecht, a Globe correspondent, is entitled, "Fisherman Lands Rare Catch on Cape Cod, Reels in Striped Tiger Shark Near Falmouth." Nate Ruette has fished all up and down New England, the East Coast, even abroad. But last week, he didn't have to go so far to land the best catch of his life. In an absolutely surreal experience, Ruette, 23, and his older brother Nelson reeled in a tiger shark off a beach near Falmouth in the early morning hours on Thursday, before removing the hook and releasing it. "My brother and I grew up summering on Cape Cod, fishing stripers, albies, tuna, fluke, the whole game," said Ruette, who lives in Brookline. "I never thought in a million years I'd run into a tiger, and to catch one off the beach, even though it's a juvenile, was really crazy." Ruette works for On the Water magazine, a regional fishing publication, and tries to get to the water as much as possible, even during the week. The brothers had been fishing with eel bait, expecting just to catch a few sand sharks. Instead, they reeled in a bluish-gray tiger shark with horizontal stripes, about 5 feet long and weighing 40 pounds. Ruette said it was a rare treat to see a southern warmer water species in familiar Cape waters. According to John Chisholm, a shark researcher with the New England Aquarium, the presence of tiger sharks in Massachusetts waters is increasing every year as the water warms. These southern species are slowly increasing their range north, Chisholm said. Historically, though, we've had tiger shark sightings going back decades, but they were rare. Chisholm, who helps track shark sightings, said juvenile tiger sharks have appeared near Cape Cod in the past 4 to 5 years, though it's still rarer to catch one from the beach. Recently, Chisholm said, he got reports from Mashpee, not far from where Ruette and his brother were fishing, of a tiger shark eating the carcass of a leatherback turtle that had been killed by a boat. After seeing pictures of Ruette's catch on Friday, Chisholm confirmed it was a tiger shark. Ruette agreed that as waters have warmed, he has seen a wider variety of catches. With the tiger shark, which is considered highly dangerous to humans, he and his brother wanted to be extra careful to handle it properly and made sure to keep it wet while on the beach. The next day at work, Ruette said his boss, head editor of On the Water magazine, was stunned when he saw a photo of the catch. Everyone said, "That's the catch of a lifetime on the Cape," Ruette recalled. Moving on to the business section, this is an article by Aaron Pressman of the Globe staff. It's entitled eBay and Former Executives to Pay $56 million to Settle Suit for Harassment of Natick Couple. Almost 7 years after a group of eBay employees harassed and stalked Ina and David Steiner, the Natick couple on Monday agreed to a final $55.7 million settlement of their lawsuit against the company and some of its former top executives. The couple's law firm, Scully Murphy Law PC, announced the settlement on Monday evening and filed a notice in U.S. District Court in Boston dismissing all charges from the Steiners' lawsuit. The deal could bring some solace to the Steiners, whose quiet suburban life was ripped apart in 2019 when people working for eBay bombarded them with online threats and bizarre deliveries, including a bloody pig mask, live spiders, and a funeral wreath. The scheme, which also included following the couple around town and trying to attach a tracker to their car, started after eBay's former CEO, Devin Weinig, complained about coverage of the company on the Steiner's website, E-Commerce Bytes. Seven people who worked for eBay ultimately pleaded guilty to criminal charges, 4 served time in prison, and the company paid a $3 million penalty, but no senior executives were charged. Now the e-commerce giant will pay the Steiners $46.15 million. Former chief executive Weinig will pay the couple $2 million. Former chief communication officer Stephen Weimer will pay $50,000. And former chief of global operations Wendy Jones will pay $500,000. The company also agreed to donate $6 million to various charities, and Weinig will donate $1 million to a charity dedicated to protecting First Amendment rights in the name of Ina Steiner. The company also posted a statement admitting that the harassment was wrong, reprehensible, and should never have happened. Unlike many settlements, the agreement does not include a confidentiality clause prohibiting the Steiners from speaking publicly, and eBay will issue a strongly worded public statement regarding the conduct of its former executives. The stalking began as early as 2018 when Weinig complained to his communications team about critical coverage on the Steiner's site, according to emails made public as part of a settlement the company struck with prosecutors to avoid charges. Jones, then senior vice president of global operations, wrote that the company should clap back at Ina in one message, Weimer hired at the beginning of 2019, told subordinates to F with her, and wrote, I want to blow her site up. Weinig's complaints continued. In May 2019, he wrote to Weimer, I couldn't care less what she says and take her down, in reference to Ina Stirner. And in an August 2019 text conversation, the CEO wrote, if we're ever going to take her down, now is the time. The articles that drew the eBay executives' ire included reports on the CEO's salary and his comments about protecting e-sellers from fraud. On August 15, 2019, several of their employees traveled to Boston. They tried to install a GPS tracking device on the Steiner's car and follow David Steiner around Natick. After the Steiners reported to local police the license plate number of the rental car the eBay team was using to stalk them, the scheme unraveled. The Steiners filed their lawsuit in 2021. The 2019 scheme to intimidate, threaten, torture, terrorize, stalk, and silence the Steiners was successful and harmful, the Steiners lawsuit stated. And while we're not usually reading obituaries, we will read one today for a famous person that has died. This is written by Brian Marquard of the Globe staff. This is regarding Margot Howard, 1940 to 2026. Her roots were royal, but she charted her own unique course on dispensing advice. A successful Chicago newspaper columnist and magazine writer early in her career, Margot Howard kept her distance from her famous family's profession of handing out advice until she was 57, when her favorite editor persuaded her to take over writing the Dear Prudence column for the online magazine Slate in 1998. Her mother was the legendary Esther Eppy Letterer, whose Ann Landers advice column reached about 1,200 newspapers and 90 million readers at the time of her death in 2002. Before writing Dear Prudence, Ms. Howard had brushed aside numerous other editors who wanted her to follow in her mother's advice-giving footsteps. She even turned down her mother's offer to simply take over the daily Ann Landers column. At Slate, editor Michael Kinsley offered Ms. Howard something different. One Dear Prudence column a week, instead of her mother's everyday grind. And she only had to field email inquiries from readers. I didn't have to deal with the picture in my head of my mother with letters, pounds and pounds and tons of letters. No paper would pass through my hands, she told the interviewer Connie Martinson in California in 2003. When I started, I must tell you, I was the most surprised of anybody. I loved it. Ms. Howard, who drew wisdom from her own experiences while writing online advice column and a memoir during 3 decades in Cambridge, died July 13th. She was 86, had retired to Sarasota, Florida several years ago, and her health had declined over the past couple of years, her family said. Business success and advice column fame formed Ms. Howard's early life. Her father, Jules Lederer, helped launch Budget Rent-A-Car. Her mother's twin, Pauline Phillips, penned the Dear Abby advice column that was a newspaper rival to Ann Landers, creating a sibling rivalry that sometimes edged into bitterness. Ms. Howard earned her own international fame, especially when many newspapers that had carried Ann Landers began publishing a print version of Dear Prudence as a replacement upon Miss Leader's death. Ms. Howard was funny, perverse, quirky, All of the Above in Great Abundance, said Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker Errol Morris of Cambridge. And there may be something absurd about saying this, he said, chuckling, but she was somebody you could always ask for advice.
And we'll finish today with the notebook section of the Globe. Netanyahu, Trump beat for first time since starting the war. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he had an excellent meeting with President Trump at the White House on Tuesday, their first sit-down, since launching a war against Iran that offered Netanyahu a chance to smooth out relations strains in their relationship. An Israeli official briefed on the meeting said Netanyahu made it clear to Trump and to his cabinet that if Iran were to attack Israel, they would respond, but that beyond that, they would trust the judgment of the president regarding next steps. And from the Associated Press, Senate confirms Clayton to lead intelligence agency. The Senate on Tuesday confirmed Jay Clayton to become the head of the nation's intelligence agencies, putting a permanent director in place weeks after Trump sought to delay his nomination. Republicans had initially hoped to confirm Clayton in June, but Trump delayed the hearing in order to allow his temporary pick for the job to take over for several weeks. Senators from both parties have expressed concerns about Polte. And that will conclude our reading today from the Boston Globe. Boston Globe Live is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Programming is funded in part by the Memorial Foundation and for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. We thank you for listening and hope you have enjoyed today's session.
Hello once again, Audio Journal listeners. This is Bill Ruggiero with your latest weather forecast for Wednesday, July 29th, 2026. While we do have an aerial flood watch until 8 p.m. tonight. That's a flood watch until 8 p.m. tonight. So here's my latest updated forecast. For today, we'll have heavy rain and thunderstorms, likely windy and cooler, highs near 69 to 72 degrees. For tonight, heavy rain until midnight, then tapering to showers after midnight. Lows will be near 54 degrees. And the outlook for Thursday is called for mostly cloudy skies with a stray shower in the afternoon, possible thunderstorm. Highs Thursday near 75 degrees. Thursday night, mostly clear skies, low around 54 degrees. And the outlook for Friday is called for mostly sunny skies with an outside chance of a shower likely in the afternoon. That shower will be isolated. Highs on Friday near 81 degrees. Friday night, mostly clear skies, low around 65 degrees. And the outlook for Saturday is called for mostly sunny skies. Highs on Saturday in the middle 80s. That, folks, is your latest weather forecast for Wednesday, July 29th, 2026. This has been Bill Ruggiero saying have a good and happy day, everybody. And please stay tuned for more programming coming up next on Audio Journal. Take care. Have a wonderful Wednesday, everybody. Bye.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Join Cooking in the Dark. Heard each and every Saturday mornings from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Join Cheryl Cummings and Dale Campbell as they discuss their favorite recipes. And also, they do tell jokes. Well, I'm just joking. That's Cooking in the Dark. Heard each and every Saturday mornings from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. right here on Audio Journal. And they are great. Cheryl and Dale. Oh, yeah. Cook the food, Dale.